gracias. And that's about all the Spanish I'm going to use today. I could do this in French or Italian, but unfortunately not in Spanish. So to spare you, I'll stick with English. I just want to thank Anna and my other introducers for this wonderful welcome, for the incredible or impressive or wonderful introduction to my work. And so it occurs to me that I need to set this into context. And having worked a lot on policies about political economy and the welfare state, looking at Europe and elsewhere, having deepened the analysis of ideas and discourse and discursive institutionalism, I should just say two words about how I came to that. And it really was about the time I was working with Fritz Scharpf on welfare and work in the open economy with all of these wonderful social scientists working with us. And since we were looking at the impact of international institutions on international economic pressures in particular on the welfare state, changes in institutions, policies, what I found is that most of my colleagues were focused on the institutions and the policies, almost nothing on the agents, and certainly no ideas or discourse. And it was because of that, and not the politics. There were only one or two collaborators who were focused even talking about the politics, and I thought, how can you talk about the reform of the welfare state without talking about the politics and basically the ideas? You know, politics, and everyone was talking about more rationalist economistic approaches, the politics as usual, and of course this was not politics as usual. How could you explain how vast numbers of workers for whom these kinds of reforms went against their own interests somehow changed their minds and accepted these kinds of reforms? And for me, it meant that you had to actually talk about the politics, but in terms of the ideas, and you had to talk about the values that were involved and the transformation of the welfare state and the leadership involved. And that's really how I started. It was about that time, in the mid to late 90s, that I started focusing more on ideas and discourse, not to the exclusion of the rest, because for me, you need to know all the rest, if only as background information, for looking at the agents, the discursive interactions, who's talking to whom about what, the nature of persuasion and influence that's involved. It's not simply, you have to get people to elect you, for example. How do you do that? So that's how this began, and I've written a number of different things using discursive institutionalism since, and also trying to develop what discursive institutionalism is. And for me, what I wanted to do is use discursive institutionalism as an analytic framework, just as rational choice institutionalism, historical institutionalism and sociological institutionalism for analytic frameworks. One looks mostly at calculation of interest, another looks at path dependencies or incremental change in institutions, the other looks at frames and cultural frames. Each of those is a different analytic framework, and what I wanted to do is say there is yet another analytic framework, the fourth new institutionalism, discursive institutionalism, in which there are actually already a lot of scholars who have focused on ideas and discursive interaction. And we need to put them together, and mine was a bit of an identification exercise. We need to put these scholars together so that they can talk to one another, so that in a way they constitute a field, and that they learn from one another, and others can see that this is also another potential tool in the toolkit of analysis. I had no intention of saying this is the only way to do things. On the contrary, I tend to be a methodological pluralist, but in order to be a methodological pluralist, you need plural methods. And you definitely need ideas and discourse that can lend insight into the politics. And the politics of change, this is about the dynamics of change and not just statics, if you will. So that's a very by way of a very long introduction. How do I get to the resilience of neoliberal ideas? In my work before, it was focused on theorizing discursive interactions, a coordinative discourse amongst policy actors, a communicative discourse by political leaders with the general public, so it's elites in public. But I hadn't done that much on theorizing ideas. And actually, American political science hadn't done that much, American comparative politics. And so what I thought with my co-author for then co-editor for the book Resilient Liberalism in Europe's Political Economy is that this time we would focus only on the ideas. Most importantly, because if you look at the transformations of the welfare state, of labor markets, if you look today at the Eurozone crisis, actually look more generally at the financial crisis, what you see is that it's actually about ideas about how you govern the economy and what you do in that context in terms of labor and the welfare state. And what's really interesting is that even economists have rediscovered ideas. It's just the political scientists who tend to be a bit slow about this. So for us, it was a question of, so how do we explain that we have the biggest crisis, arguably of the century, well, actually of this century, yes, but the second largest, perhaps, you know, in economic terms, of the last century. This rivals the Great Depression, or could have rivaled the Great Depression, in terms of the impact on people's lives, in terms of the economy. I mean, leaving aside wars and all of that, which is a completely different topic. Given that, my question, our question was, and the question of the collaborators in this book is, how do we explain the resilience of neoliberal ideas? The resilience, I mean, Keynes came back for 9 months. 9 months. And then everyone said, oh, no, now we've solved the problem. We take, you know, a couple of ideas from Keynes, throw it at the problem, now it works. And it's actually much more the problem of Europe than of the US. The US has been much more pragmatic about this. You've had Ben Bernanke, who was a student of the Great Depression, said, I'm gonna get the policies right regardless. No, it's in Europe. So for us, the big puzzle, the big question is how do you explain the resilience of neoliberal ideas in Europe? But of course, it's not just in Europe, it's also beyond. The Europeans might have spearheaded it, but you can talk about the IMF. But actually, the IMF, more in the past, the IMF all of a sudden is the one saying, hey, we don't think we want the Washington Consensus in Europe. And it's the European Commission that says, no, you have to do it. You have to do it in Central and Eastern Europe in 2008. You have to do it in Southern Europe in 2010. So this is by way of introduction to say, it's a big question, and how do you explain it? And political science scientists really haven't explained it or attempted as much. So this is our effort to try to explain resilience. So let's think about the resilience of liberal political economic ideas. So in this book, and actually in my talk, neoliberal ideas are the main focus, but it's in the context of liberalism more generally. And I think it's important to remember neoliberalism is part of a larger body of thought that's liberal. And we take the position that ideas are worth exploring in themselves. We're not talking about neoliberal policy effects. We're not talking about the implementation of neoliberal policies. We've done this in the past, and for this, the problem is neoliberal ideas are one thing. How they get put into practice is actually something very different. There are lots of intervening variables, there are existing institutions, existing policies, there are battles amongst different coalitions of actors, so what you get in practice may not look like the purest kind of theory. It involves hybridization of various kinds. So we said, no, you know, it gets too messy if you're trying. And other people have done this. There's a tremendous literature out there about what neoliberal policies are. You can talk about privatization, you can talk about deregulation, you can talk about restructuring the welfare state, introducing competition into health and welfare policies, deregulating welfare, you know, labor markets, et cetera, et cetera. I need not go on, you all know about this. So we're talking about ideas, not necessarily taking it to its impact. And our point is that ideas are important for constituting interests. For the very long time, the assumption was, you know, there are interests, and that's it. But, you know, it's ideas about interests. I mean, part of the problem with the term interests is it's confusing. Is it interest groups that we're talking about, or is it the interests people have, the economic interests? Often these are conflated. But what we're trying to do is say interests in terms of economic interests, et cetera, ideas are important for constituting interests. Do you know, I mean, this is a constructivist point, but do you really know what is in your best interest? No, someone's going to tell you. Or you will think about what these are, but that can change very quickly. For the welfare state in the post-war period, it was in your interest to have generous welfare benefits, et cetera. Something changed subsequently. And neoliberal ideas were, I think, essential to having people think, no, their interests are different. Ideas are important for framing debates, the way in which one can have a debate, and what you can't talk about. Can anyone talk about Marxism anymore? Oh, sorry, we're in Latin America. You can talk about Marxism. In the US, no. Actually, it's probably coming back. But neoliberalism actually tends to frame most debates in recent years. But ideas are also important in choosing strategies and policies, and also in legitimating decisions. You don't know why you made that decision. It's the result of compromise. But now you're going to explain it. You'll have a discourse explaining it that will bring it back to the neoliberal ideas or whatever, even if they don't quite fit. Okay, so this is just a quick introduction to why we think ideas matter. So in terms of my presentation, part one is going to talk about, it's going to identify neoliberal ideas and agents. So I'm going to talk about the key ideas in neoliberalism, do a brief history of neoliberal ideas, talk about the varieties of neoliberalism, the different forms of ideas, the different levels of ideas, and who the agents are. And then in part two, we're going to analyze the resilience. And here, what's the nature, how do you define resilience? We all use this term as if it's obvious, but no, we try to define what is resilience. And then we give you five potential lines of analysis to explain why or how neoliberalism was resilient. And what I should say is, in the book, our contributors use these five lines of analysis that you'll find about shortly to try to analyze what was going on in their area. And of course, what you find is that different one or another of these lines of analysis may help you explain this or that sector, domain, country. So very quickly now, defining neoliberalism. I'm just going to go through this very fast. There are many definitions. It's multivariate. And of course, can you call anyone a neoliberal? That's a sign of, isn't that, you know, you dirty neoliberal, you? No. It's sometimes used as a curse word, basically. So neoliberals themselves often don't identify themselves as neoliberal. We're an economic liberal. You know, it's about economic liberalism. So difficult to define if there's so many definitions. But what we come down to is neoliberalism, you need to think of it as a core set of ideas about markets and the state's role in it, or as part of markets. It's really about that. And the notion is markets should be free. They should be governed by competition, open across borders. How many times, I mean, think about this. The word competition is everywhere. It is used all the time. I saw one sentence that Chancellor Merkel used in a speech, and she used competition three times in the same sentence. We have to, it's important to be competitive because we have to be competitive because we are competitive, or some such thing. So markets should be free, and the state should have a limited political and economic role to create and preserve the institutional framework. And, you know, it's all of the things you know: secure property rights, guarantee competition, there we have the word again, free trade, promote labor market flexibility, reduce welfare dependence, marketize the provision of public goods. So this is all about increasing the market, reducing the size of the state. So what about the history? And importantly, we keep thinking about neoliberalism as all about economics, but it's really about the political economy. It's all also about political democracy and the role of the state. So if we look at the intellectual origins, this is just a nice little fact. You know, when you talk about liberalism in English, there's only one word. You know, there's liberal, and then you say neoliberal, but in Italian, there's liberalesimo, liberalismo, and liberismo. This is Maurizio Ferrera, a contributor on the welfare state chapter, who makes this point at length, and we pick it up in the introduction, because liberalesimo is the whole history of liberalism as a political philosophy, etc. Liberalismo is liberalism as an economic philosophy, and liberismo is neoliberalism. I think this is useful in order to understand that neoliberalism is a narrowing of liberalism to a particular approach, as opposed to the only way to think about liberalism. This is important, because if you reject neoliberalism, it doesn't mean that you need to go to the other side, whichever side that is, because you can talk about populism just as much as you can talk about some variant of Marxism, or social democracy even. But no, think about going back to the roots of liberalism, which is not nearly as narrow. And if we go back in terms of the history of political philosophy, republicanism is a philosophy where the community comes first, and there's the individual comes second. In liberalismo, the individual comes first, the community second. So this is Hume, this is even Adam Smith, this is Locke, but this is, I mean, I guess Locke is yeah, liberalismo, liberalesimo, actually. But it's also John Stuart Mill. In liberismo, neoliberalism, the market comes first and the polity second. And that's an important reversion. And what you see is, in terms of the history and the kinds of approaches, the market is first. So history begins in the interwar period, revives in the 1950s, we'll go into that, and remains marginal really until the 1970s, 80s, when you get the end of the Bretton Woods system and the two oil shocks. And it begins actually in Vienna, and Hayek was a minor person in the 1920s, but you do have Hayek in Vienna, who then actually goes to the LSE. You have ordo-liberalism in Germany. So ordo-liberalism is neoliberalism with rules. There are others in the UK. So in the 30s, what you see is the developing of the philosophy, of a philosophical approach. This is in the midst of fascism. And these are people who are reacting against fascism on the one hand and what they see as communism on the other. And so they want something in between, and they find that the market is the answer. And they all get together in Paris for a colloque Lippmann. This is Walter Lippmann, the American, who's invited over to Paris just on the eve of World War II. And it's the grand messe, it's everyone is there. Everyone who's anyone then, and actually after the war as well, who become heads of state, et cetera. And they then reform themselves into what becomes the Mont Pèlerin Society, beginning in the 1950s, and it's, you have to think of it as a thought collective. There's a really wonderful book that was published by Harvard University Press on this, and it's quite extraordinary who all is there, and it's a thought collective where they agree that we have to go out and spread these ideas. In the 1960s and on, you have Friedman at the University of Chicago, you have Hayek at the London School of Economics, you have James Buchanan and Gordon Tullock, the Virginia School, but they are in the margins. They are training economists and others, but they're on the margins. So what are the variations of neoliberalism over time? In the post-war period, actually neoliberalism barely exists. It really is being taught by a few lunatics. No, I didn't say that. People who were seen actually as very strange, strange ideas, completely out of the mainstream. Keynesianism was central. That's what governments did. That's who was hired to run government departments, at least in the US and Europe. And it's actually only in the 1950s that ordoliberalism comes in. It's neoliberalism with rules, but, and this is important, there's a compromise with social democracy. Ludwig Erhard, who was at the Colloque Lippmann in 38, who is a strong neoliberal, compromises with the Social Democrats. Social Democratic Party and labor in particular, and says, okay, macroeconomic policy is ordo-liberal, we're focused on stability, we don't want inflation, etc. But labor and welfare state is social democratic, and this is fine. He writes to Hayek, and Hayek says, oh, I don't like this at all, and he says, no, but I thought you'd like it, because this is creating a rules-based society in which these rules actually help serve the interests of stability. Hayek wasn't convinced, but Germany starts on a path, so much so that no one remembers that Germany's ordo-liberal. They don't even know what the word means until very, very recently. Actually, until the macroeconomic stability rules have migrated to the European Central Bank and then come back to haunt everyone else in the Eurozone crisis. Okay, but it's not till the 1980s that you get the conservative neoliberalism. This is the rollback of the state to free the markets. It's Thatcher in Britain. It's Reagan in the US. And there are just some wonderful lines if we ask ourselves, what about ideas and discourse? It's in the US, it's Reagan, this is in terms of the welfare state, it's Reagan talking about welfare queens. It's in Britain, it's Thatcher talking about the worthy poor as opposed to the feckless and the idle. She also said wonderful lines, the right to be unequal. I like that one. And of course, the one that you've heard many times before, there's no such thing as society. There are only individual men and women and families. So this is a radical attack on what she saw as the socialists in Britain at the time. But we then get in the 1980s, there's also, of course, this is the beginning of the Washington Consensus, the notion that there needs to be capital mobility everywhere, and markets need to open in what was then called the Third World. By the 1990s and 2000s, this is really a social democratic rescue of neoliberalism. Neoliberalism hadn't thought through, actually, what do you do once you've got power, once you've actually deregulated? And then you've got messes. You deregulate the financial markets, and all of a sudden you've got insider trading. You, in a whole range of areas, significant problems. And the result is that it's the new center. It's the new Democrats, it's new Labor, it's Schroeder in Germany, it's Jospin even in France, where he's got the ideas without the discourse, because you don't dare in France talk about neoliberalism other than as a dirty word. But they're all basically, in a way, save neoliberalism. This is the rollout of the state to enhance the markets. So rather than the roll back, it's the rollout. in 2010, with the Eurozone crisis, you can call it the ramp up of the state, as you intensify ordo-neoliberalism. There are the EU, the various pacts and compacts on austerity and structural reform. You know, the Maastricht Treaty said you had to have stability rules, 3% deficit, no more than 3% deficit, moving towards 60% debt, et cetera. Once the euro is agreed and starts coming in, they agree on the Stability and Growth Pact. Actually, it was originally called the Stability Pact. Jospin gets elected. He insists that we have to have growth. So they add growth to the name, and that was it. There's no growth in the Stability and Growth Pact. And then once 2010 and the Greek rescue happens, and then the bailout funds for countries in danger of contagion, you get a series of pacts. You get the six-pack, the two-pack, the fiscal compact, all basically reinforcing the rules that all countries have to have low deficits, debt, et cetera, and it's austerity, and structural reform. I still don't know what structural reform actually means, but we kind of do. But no one ever defines it. It's fascinating. Just go look everywhere. It's another one of those buzzwords like competition. So this is actually a new synthesis with regard to the state, and I think this is important. I call it liberal neo-statism. This is not the neoliberal state that the philosophers talked about. It's liberal neo-statism. That's because there's a basic contradiction in neoliberalism. Neoliberalism says we want as little state as possible. I mean, some variants want more than others, but basically it's very little state and lots of market. But the contradiction is you need actually a lot of state in order to make for neoliberalism. So it's liberal neo-statism. The state has been reinforced over time, not diminished, but it's a different kind of state. It's neo-statism, and it's of a liberal variety. Okay. Here we go. But there are tremendous variations in terms of neoliberalism over country and sector. There are national variants for the US, the UK, and Irish. This is the, you know, sort of the growth model is essentially with financial markets. It's the, in the US, it was mortgage securitization that actually led to the financial crisis. But in the UK and the and Ireland, they didn't do the mortgage securitization, but it's a very similar thing. When you don't increase, when you don't think you can, increase salaries over the long term, when the real wage actually stayed steady or went down in these countries, how do you make people happy? How do you get yourself reelected? Well, one way you do it is you switch the whole financial setup. You don't give people higher salaries. You ensure that they can buy houses. So you make mortgages easier to get and increasingly easier, which explains the subprime crisis in the US. In the UK, you know, you just flip the houses more so that you get unreal values for the houses. But this means that people now get increases in their ability to buy things through their houses. They get credit. So it's about a debt-fueled economy as opposed to real growth in anything else. And these are the US, UK, and Irish growth models. And certainly the US and the UK have just gone right back into it. They haven't changed their models. And it's a neoliberal model at the point at which you say, okay, low wages for unskilled, and I mean, it's true that the high skilled can have, okay. Sweden and Denmark have a corporatist adaptation. There are neoliberal reforms, but they actually remain reasonably universalist. Germany ends up dualizing the labor market, and that's the Schroeder Hartz IV reforms, Hartz IV, which really cuts the sort of the link basically with pensions, gets rid of the sort of the sense of pensions as a property right, essentially, and on. And so you actually get Germany and Sweden and Denmark had been relatively similar, and they divide much more with the increased neoliberalism, and they come late to neoliberalism, in fact. The French and Italian state transformations provide something different, but I'm not going to go into those. But there are sectoral variants, and I think this is important. For European monetary union, so we're talking about the euro here, the Brussels-Frankfurt consensus is one that's essentially ordo-liberalism is key. As described before, and as I mentioned at the very beginning, this is about the rescue of the Washington consensus. I mean, most significantly, if you find in the central, Central Eastern European countries, there's one moment when the Hungarian prime minister says, please don't allow another iron curtain, an economic iron curtain, to come down and divide us. And the European member states, you know, say, basically, go to hell. Sorry, go to the IMF. And then the IMF said, but you know, you are European after all. We're not going to do to you what we did to Latin America and Asia, you know, because you are European, advanced, industrialized. And they recommended that, say, Latvia depeg from the euro. Well, the European Commission would not have it. The European Commission basically said, no, it has to be as harsh as you've always been. This is about moral hazard, another neoliberal idea, but it's actually an economic idea, et cetera. And the same thing then happens with Southern Europe. In finance, there are no alternatives to neoliberalism, but there are divisions in it. It's either light touch or don't touch. Light touch regulation, where the state is involved in market enhancing, or it's don't touch, it's laissez-faire. But those are the two alternatives, and they remain that way. Competition policy is basically one size for it fits all in terms of antitrust. It's interesting, labor market activation policy, which is a neoliberal idea after all, but they're very different adaptations. Denmark and the UK are completely different, and actually it works in Denmark to provide training, et cetera, to workers and you know, out of work, and they retrain and they get into other jobs. In the UK, doesn't work. Welfare is interesting because this is Maurizio Ferreira's chapter. He essentially says, look, you've got to recognize that the welfare state is different. It was not initially neoliberal. You know, finance is created as neoliberal. The financial markets barely exist compared to what they became, and they became what they became largely because of neoliberal ideas about the deregulation and the way in which the financial markets are key to everything else. But the welfare state had a deep origin in social democracy. And so Maurizio Ferreira argues, actually, you know, neoliberal ideas have had an impact, but not in the deep sense. There's still social democratic values that are at their basis. Nonetheless, neoliberal policies have come in, and you see increasing competition and the provision of services, et cetera. But I think it's important. So I used liberal neo-statism for what happens with the state, but it's a very different phenomenon from what we're talking about here when we talk about liberal neo-welfareism. Okay, now very quickly, different forms and levels of neoliberal ideas. It can get confusing, but really, at a most general level, I'll just go through them very quickly, there are philosophical ideas. At a deep level, you can talk about worldviews, ideologies, core values, discourse in Foucault's sense. These sort of deep views of deep philosophies about how the world should work. For neoliberalism, it's about the individual responsibility, the necessary freedom of markets, a limited state, and of course, discourse. There's an intermediate level, though, a sort of programmatic idea. Some people call these paradigms. But they're policy programs that may change over time, and it's actually, if you think about the 1980s, a conservative neoliberalism, the 1990s, the social democratic variety today, the kind of program of the Eurozone, those are kind of programs, those involve you have to talk about different kinds of methods, instruments, etc. But there's a very immediate level of policy ideas. And it's important to think about the different levels, because if you don't, then you're going to say, oh yeah, Neo-Keynesian came in for 9 months and then was abandoned, and you think about this big Neo-Keynesian project. Well, no, it was neoliberal, it was Keynesian policy ideas. And even a truly committed neoliberal, like Alan Greenspan, said, yeah, these policies are okay. So it's important. And Mario Draghi, who is the president of the ECB, basically is perfectly happy to use non-orthodox policies. Even now, quantitative easing. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the program has changed, and certainly that the philosophical ideas are changed. And I think that's just an important differentiation to make. And of course, change comes at differential rates with differing effects. Philosophical ideas tend to change most slowly. Whenever I come to Chile, which is only twice, I keep asking people about, okay, so tell me about the implantation of neoliberal ideas. And what I actually hear is there's a deep neoliberal philosophy here. You know, you talk about worldview or attitudes, but that you can actually have a policy programs, you can have change in the policy programs, and maybe even in the policy ideas. But what's important here, and this is why one also should think about these changes, it's a question. If you have change in policies, what effect do they have on the program, and can't they transform the program? And if you have changes in the program over time, isn't it possible that the philosophical ideas themselves will change? So one needs to, it's useful to think about these different levels, because it's also useful to think about, well, how does change occur in terms of the introduction of new ideas? At which level? Often very difficult to change philosophy. But you introduce certain policy ideas. They become a political program. This works for thinking about how the world changed from the post-war period, at least the advanced industrialized world changed in the post-war period, to neoliberalism. As ideas were introduced, you had Thatcher talking about neoliberalism, the circulation of ideas, and slowly but surely, neoliberalism becomes a worldview. So that at the end, I always tell people, and in certain circles, in certain places that I present this and say this, people are not happy, but I say, you know, we are all neoliberals now. This is the way we all see the world, perhaps in Chile a bit more strongly neoliberal than elsewhere, but, you know, we all talk about competition as if that's the only way to go. No one thinks about cooperation. Social solidarity, okay, but equality? No. Merit. It's interesting that the world has changed, and that's fine. Then the question is, how does the world change some more? Okay, I'll go more quickly now. Agents of neoliberalism. So think about agents of neoliberalism as ideational entrepreneurs. And there can be ideological ones, Ludwig Erhard in Germany, Thatcher certainly in Britain, Einaudi in Italy, except he was a president and didn't have any power, so he didn't really change much. The pragmatic sorts, Blair and Schroeder, although some people would argue that they too were opportunistic, but certainly the opportunists, Berlusconi, Sarkozy. You tell me where Chile enters, which figures in Chile enter into these, and I suppose you can be both two or three of these at the same time. But it's important not just to look at the leaders and the politicians, but think about the circulation of ideas. This is about discursive communities. It's what I've already mentioned, the Montpellier Society, thought collectives, but it's also think tanks, tremendously important. The American Enterprise Institute in the US, the Institute of Directors in Britain, but you can identify in any country the development of neoliberal thought collectives or think tanks that have pushed a certain set of ideas with an agenda. It's about advocacy coalitions. It's about economists and expert networks. And I think this is important because when you think about central bankers, when you think about IMF experts. This is about the circulation of ideas. There's a real good study going on now about how the IMF had a training institute in Vienna, and I think for a short-term period had, you know, junior economists on their way up from around the world, Latin America, Asia, as well as the US, who then, many years later, end up in positions of authority. And then all of a sudden, you get a change in, you know, the finance institute or whatever. But it's efficient markets and rational man models. You know, we're all rational, and therefore, but we're all economically rational, et cetera. You know, this is when political scientists, no one ever, you know, people stopped listening to political scientists. The economists know everything, so okay. Public servants, it's also about new public management. And what that did to destroy trust in public servants, in public service, and actually meant that you lost a lot of the free labor that you got. You know, we can't trust public servants. They're all in the business of trying to collect rents, et cetera. You lose the free labor that you got at the point at which you assume that everything is about incentives. Okay, now we move on to, so how do we talk about, how do we analyze resilience? I'm not going to go into this in great depth, but basically resilience has three key elements. It's about continuity, stability, or recurrence. It's putting old ideas in new ways. It's the 1920s store of money that becomes austerity. It's a process of translation and diffusion. But so continuity, stability, recurrence. It can, you know, it can change over time, but the sort of the core ideas remain. Number two is the dominance in policy debates. It's the usual conventional analytic framework. It's what I said about, you know, we're all neoliberals now. Competition is a catchword, as I already said. And the state is always inefficient. There was a time when people thought that the state actually could do things. Survival in the face of challenges. There have been internal failures, rival alternatives. I mean, think about the way in which the 1990s and early 2000s were depicted. The great moderation. And yet you got bigger and bigger crises constantly. But because the markets recovered, everyone said, no, this is the great moderation. Again, it's survival in the face of challenges. Or if you take the notion of corporate governance, it's the shareholder model that remains strongest, even though stakeholder model that said unions should be involved, et cetera, didn't have anything. So how do we explain resilience? So we have five lines of analysis. The first is the ideational generality, diversity, and mutability of neoliberalism. I've already used the example of the active labor market policy. It can be very different in the UK versus Denmark. It's a set of core principles or values. You know, it's got high plasticity. And it can't be disproven. And there are processes of metamorphosis, absorption, hybridization. You know, it's like the hydra. You cut off one head, two new ones pop up. Metamorphosis from, say, the 1920s views to the 1980s, 1990s, monetarism is a replay of some old ideas about how you deal with money. But it's also about absorption. So we had a post-war social democratic welfare state, and it becomes liberal neo-welfarism. It actually, if you can't beat them, you get absorbed. If you can't beat it, you can't change it entirely, you get absorbed. And then hybridization. Benefits of non-implementation. This is about rhetoric versus reality. Talk a good game, don't do it. Actually, if you did it, in many cases, you will never get reelected. The claims of neoliberal politicians in the campaigns, you know, we're going to cut the welfare state back to the 1920s. We're going to cut spending back to, et cetera. Well, and they get in power, and guess what? It doesn't happen. And that's a good thing. That's why they can get reelected. And if they don't get reelected, very shortly thereafter, the new generation of politicians said they never did that. David Cameron, as if Margaret Thatcher never existed. It's quite extraordinary. So it's very useful in campaign discourse. Berlusconi used it, and then, of course, he also never implemented it. Sarkozy, same thing. Sarkozy became the best neo-Keynesian going for a couple years, and then, of course, switched back to neoliberalism and David Cameron. Just go on. The strength in policy and political debates, as opposed to the alternatives. In many areas, it's presented as there are no alternatives. In finance, it's laissez-faire or market enhancing, as I've already talked about. And perhaps it's not about the strength of neoliberal ideas, but the weakness of the alternatives. Where are the social democrats in all of this? We can talk later about why they're not there, but it's as if there are no alternatives. But it also may be that neoliberalism seems like common sense. It's got real communicative power in discourse. So Chancellor Merkel can say in a speech to the Schwabian housewife, "You understand why we need to have austerity. You run the household. You know that when you're in debt, you know, when you've overspent, you have to tighten your belt. Well, so do governments." Well, no, it's common sense. But actually, you know, Keynes has led us to understand that you have to spend as you're in a recession, and then you can, once you're in doing better, you can then pay down your debt, but certainly don't. So it does mean that you have to get deeper into debt. Do you see how long I've been talking about this? And how counterintuitive it is? In any case, it's not a 30-second soundbite. Chancellor Merkel's, you know, Schwabian housewife is a 30-second soundbite. And I think that's what's important to recognize. It's easier. More market, less state. Much easier than saying, well, actually, you do need the state for a whole range of things. Because without it, you know, then we have to talk about welfare, we have to talk about labor markets, et cetera. Number four, it's about the role of interests. And here we're talking about interest groups. It's self-interested actors and coalitions of interests who promote neoliberal ideas to achieve their aims, to prevent alternative ideas from coming to the surface. So it's political parties, it's large firms. Using the mass media, Berlusconi, Murdoch, it's essentially the way in which, also if you have the power of the media, or you have the power of money. It's in the US now, it's financial market actors. They're never going to see serious reforms because they're the ones who provide the campaign finance for the Democrats and the Republicans. And if you're very clever about this, you can appear to be giving to both at the same time to make sure that there will be never any serious laws against you. But it's also about feedback mechanisms. The minute you've got more power and more money, you can pay more money in the campaign contributions. It becomes harder to change the system. Deregulation and liberalization, low taxes have benefited the large firms. The bankers are laughing all the way to the bank. Oh no, you don't cut my taxes. No, no. Actually, a few have been saying it more recently, but essentially it's all in their interests. And the role of interest has been to reinforce this. And there's actually been a new literature in the US about all of this and the way in which lobbies, business lobbies, have reinforced the neoliberal ideas. But of course, frequently neoliberalism damages its supporters. But we won't go into that here. Role of institutions. For those of you who like institutional analysis, historical institutionalism, this is for you. The previous one was for the economists among us and the rationalists. Okay, yeah, it's all about interests. Here, it's about institutions. Institutions shape the endurance, the dominance, and the survival of neoliberal ideas. They're adopted or adapted into different institutional environments. It's about embedding what become incentives for their maintenance. It further empowers interests. It constrains the institutionalization of alternative ideas. Just one example, think about the Eurozone crisis and the pacts and the fiscal compact. It all built on the Stability and Growth Pact, which built on the Maastricht Treaty. Much easier to say we need to reinforce the rules that we already have, rather than to say, we maybe need to revisit those rules because they're not working. And still today, they're not working, and we haven't been revisiting those rules. Are there any pathways out of neoliberalism? There are lots of internal conflicts here. There are lots of anomalies. Will it become more hybrid? Will you get a non-neoliberal synthesis? All sorts of ways in which on number one, which is, you know, the mutability of the core principles, well, maybe they're so mutable that it doesn't work. Unsustainable gaps between rhetoric and reality. Maybe at some point people will say, wait a minute, they keep talking, but they don't, these are impractical ideas, and isn't it irrelevant? The rise of stronger alternatives, what about looking to Latin America? Look at Brazil. I assume we can look at Chile as well. Where are the social democrats? Perhaps they will be developing new ideas, perhaps incrementally. Unfortunately, the people with new ideas right now in Europe are the extreme right, the populists. If you look at recent elections, Marine Le Pen in France, you look at Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, look at the neo-Nazis, the neo-Nazi party in Greece. It's quite frightening. So yes, there may be strong alternatives, but don't assume that it's going to be social democracy. Maybe Marx even will come back. And powerful interests may actually press for new ideas. What's going on in Europe is scary. And what we have already been seeing is businesses saying, wait a minute, this is a problem. In the US, you had the major earners of the planet who are saying we need to be taxed more, and in Europe as well. And then what about institutional breakdown or the creation of new institutions? And after all, when you talk about institutions, it's people acting in institutions. So perhaps they themselves will say, no, we're going to change these rules, slowly but surely. And that's it. Thank you.